This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Ewan McElraith from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast, or the Saturday one anyway, out of the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors, and it was a real mixed bag. Needless to say, there was some wildlife that we didn't see, but there was some that we did.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and a very warm welcome to you in this rather beautiful May morning. I've mentioned the Copper Beach in the car park here before, and it's just absolutely come into its own. This is the week when it's at its best. It's like a depth charge going off, frozen in time, and it's just all these leaves cascading down. Coppers, pinks, greens, you name it. Beautiful, beautiful thing. Full of the joys of the spring this week, as I say. Mr. Ewan McElraith, up in Banffshire.
Yeah, as you say, fantastic morning. The Gean's in its glory. I was just watching a road here a couple of minutes ago, just quietly walking through the valley. It's just gorgeous.
Now, coming up on this morning show, it's Mental Health Awareness Week. We're going to be hearing how a week, just 1 week of activity in the outdoors was life-changing for one young person, plus the power of plants ahead of the Fascination of Plants Day next week.
And, if that wasn't enough, we also have a mystery bird. Now, we've been told it's been too easy in the past few weeks. No one is going to get that. No one.
I'm sure that, like us, you've got a bucket list of places that you'd like to go to, or wildlife you'd like to see, any place around the world. I mean, for me, I really would like to go to Antarctica at some stage. Now, Rachel and Dan Brown run a wildlife touring company and have been to many of the places that the rest of us, frankly, just dream of. But when the pandemic struck, obviously, everything was locked down and they had to shift their focus back to the local area in Deeside and Scotland more generally. And frankly, they were not disappointed.
We've worked, travelled around a lot of the world already, to be quite honest. We've had the privilege of spending a number of seasons working in Antarctica, right through the Arctic, including places like Wrangel Island in the Russian Arctic and Kamchatka, Chukotka, all the way down through Papua New Guinea and Indonesia, New Zealand, Australia, yeah, right through Africa, a lot of Asia. So, yeah, we've had a pretty good intro to world wildlife.
But that must be an enormous range. I mean, it's not just geographically diverse, an enormous range of wildlife too, of animals.
Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal. I mean, we've spent time in Tibet watching and enjoying snow leopards.
Yeah, she's distracted.
She's found something.
You're speaking, she just doesn't care anymore.
Wildlife Tourette's, it's a problem. You can be in the middle of a conversation, then all of a sudden it'll be like, eagle, wildlife, beetle.
This is definitely not an eagle, but that is a carrion beetle. Okay. So that will have probably just found some carcass somewhere and have burrowed into it and laid eggs in it.
A little ruddy head.
Yeah. It's like a little pinecone seed as a head.
Yeah, it is a bit, yeah.
Roughly the same size too. Yeah. It's a sort of charcoal, sooty black back. Mm-hmm. It's got what looks like a tail and then this sort of rusty, almost like a cape across its shoulders.
Absolutely, yeah. So that little tail there, that's the abdomen. Mm-hmm. And then the darker kind of shield on its back, that's the elytra. So those are basically an exoskeleton that protects the wings underneath. So they just fold outwards and open, and then these amazing wings expand underneath it, and off it goes and flies around the landscape looking for the next dead thing to land on.
All right, well, we're talking about animals, the wildlife that you've seen.
It's been phenomenally varied. We have come face to face with emperor penguins in the Antarctic, swum with whale sharks in Papua, and spent time exploring the most incredible valleys in Papua New Guinea, where they're just full of birds of paradise and things like that. It's incredibly varied.
It sounds incredibly privileged too. That's on a lot of people's bucket list, I would imagine, to do just some of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a privileged thing to be able to do. And we do feel immensely lucky to be able to share those once-in-a-lifetime experiences with different people. And it's amazing to see, you know, the look on people's faces when you show them something incredible, whether it's a polar bear, a penguin, or
beetle.
A carrion beetle that they've never seen before. They never knew existed. So it's really uplifting, and you feed off that energy as well.
You've obviously built up a clientele, and you have a track record. Then along comes COVID.
Yeah, I mean, that completely changed everything for us. We were very, very busy. We had 2 years' worth of contracts all planned out at the beginning of 2020. Wild Discovery had just been launched, and then bam. In comes COVID, and of course every single contract was cancelled immediately, and you're suddenly left with a completely empty plate of work ahead of you. So it's been a challenging couple of years. I think that's putting it mildly, but we are still up and running, and no intention of stopping running yet. It's nice being in the situation we are now in spring 2022, that we are looking towards a very positive future in terms of actually getting people out and about again and being able to really engage with people, to take groups out, which is one of the biggest hurdles during COVID, and show people some amazing wildlife.
There's the point, because, you know, your background has got snow leopards, red pandas, polar bears, you name it, and now you're working in Scotland. How do they compare, Rachel?
You know, when COVID first hit, we kind of thought, oh, we're going to really miss all those big travels, the big species that you go and look for. But actually, it's been really, really nice coming back to Scotland and finding it again and exploring all those hidden gems that we haven't visited for several years, or finding new places, particularly in Deeside, in Royal Deeside, where we're based, having the time to go and explore almost everywhere locally, whereas before it'd be, you know, you go to the best bits, where now we can find the bits in between the best bits that are even better.
Oh, look. Oh, no.
I didn't get it.
Wow. What is that?
That's an oil beetle. Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. Woo. So that's not that common.
It's nearly even less common. Oil beetle.
Yeah. So these oil beetles, this is the adult. And that, again, is this huge abdomen. And we saw some elytra, the big kind of shields on the back of the last one. And these are much, much smaller. So this guy can't fly. Mm-hmm. And he's got these very, very funky antennae. And they wander around looking for plants to lay their eggs on. And the larvae actually feed on them. But they're not that common up here. They like quite dry, very well-drained soils. And that's what we're on at the moment here at Muir Dinnit. So this is a very gravelly soil. And it drains very, very well.
He's the bug man.
So what's your area of speciality then?
I like a bit of everything, but you get me talking about lichens, I can talk about lichens all day long.
Right.
Another thing of speciality we have in this area, wood ants as well. So we've been working with the Cairngorms National Park actually to help expand their knowledge of the species, particularly in the Royal Deeside, Aberdeenshire side of the Cairngorms.
I know that Dan grew up in a botanic gardens in Wales, unusual. Did you always have an ecology background?
I didn't always have an ecology background. I've always had an interest in outdoors, and I was never one of those kids that stayed inside. I was always outside finding something to do, trees to climb or...
Bringing stuff back.
Yeah, exactly. My passion has always been a little bit more kind of higher adrenaline outdoor kind of stuff, so biking and different things like that. The adrenaline activities have changed a little bit. Yeah, we've been getting in the water with basking sharks, for one thing, up in Shetland.
where we've had plunge diving gannets off Knott's Head. We've jumped in the water there to get some underwater footage, and that's pretty high adrenaline when you've got those big beaks plunging towards you.
Yeah, it's quite phenomenal actually watching and seeing the perspective from underwater. I mean, probably hopefully everybody's seen plunge diving gannets from above, and you see them going in like a dart, and they're just as phenomenal underwater, aren't they?
Yeah, and they go down and then they stop and they have a look around, see where the fish is, and then they go swimming. Yeah. And it's just not what just you expect. Yeah. Yeah.
I think people often underestimate how good Scotland is for wildlife, though, and that it does. We're talking about world-class wildlife or places we've visited, and most people probably don't realise that things like orcas, killer whales, are now really regular around the Scottish coast. So at the moment, there are daily orca sightings off Lewis and the Western Isles, the Caithness coast, Shetland, and you stand a pretty good chance, if you put time and effort in, of actually seeing something like orca, if you would say go up to Shetland in the summer and
start rubbing it in. It's one of those things I still haven't seen. After years and years and years, I still haven't seen them out in the wild.
Well, yesterday there was a pod coming down the coast of Caithness and into Sutherland, and this time of year last year they turned up on the Aberdeenshire coast. So maybe if you keep your ears and eyes to the ground, you might actually encounter orcas on the Aberdeenshire coast.
They are there. I saw reports the other day that basically they've been seen off Fraserburgh and Peterhead. Not by me, obviously. That's ridiculous.
Not by me either.
No, exactly. That was Rachel and Dan Brown of Wild Discovery at the Muir of Dinnet National Nature Reserve. We've got more from them after 7 o'clock.
Well, it reminds me of a fantastic experience. We're going up from... where were we? Lochinver up to Kinlochbervie. And scared silly with the size of the waves. And just, you know, really, really down. And suddenly, it was a pod of common dolphin just came and escorted us, you know, for about 4 hours or something. It was a fantastic experience.
I shouldn't be talking about this. They had a film on yesterday afternoon, Russ. I caught about 10 minutes of Scott of the Antarctic, you know. John Mills as Robert Falcon Scott. And it put me in mind of their expedition photographer was a guy called Herbert Ponting, and he was trying to photo. He had one of these old cameras with it on the wooden tripod, and he had it balanced on a floe of ice, and a pod of orcas came along and investigated him and started trying to tip the edge of the floe up so that he would slide off the far end. That must have been attention grabbing.
We've got an email from Ian Bruce. Said, good morning. Ewan's correct. There's a rare start. Wonderful start to the day. Out for a walk from 4 a.m, attempting to shake off the night shift. Plethora of birds, hare, roe deer, seals, and even a hairy caterpillar. Does the team think we should adopt an animal to promote the species?
Ooh.
That's Ian Bruce in St. Fergus.
I'll have a think about that, but what animal am I like to adopt? If you've got any thoughts on that, or you want to share wildlife sightings just to annoy us, frankly, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. As I alluded to earlier, next Wednesday, the 18th of May, sees the biannual Fascination of Plants Day, which is a global celebration of the power of plants in all that they offer to the world, not just the air we breathe, but things of food and medicine, clothing, well-being. There's a long, long list. The city of Aberdeen, where I am, has a long association with botany, and so is perfectly poised to be at the heart of the celebrations in Scotland. Helen went to meet local organiser Dr. Morag McFadyen, who's a lecturer at the School of Life Sciences at Robert Gordon University.
Some people might know of Francis Mason, and Francis Mason was born in Aberdeen, I think it's round about the 1741, but Francis Mason was actually the first plant hunter for Kew Gardens, I believe, and He actually took the place of Joseph Banks when he went out with Captain Cook on the second voyage. Aberdeen's always had an involvement in the likes of Britain in Bloom. In fact, it's won it numerous times. The actual garden that we're sitting in, Duffy Park in Aberdeen, and the David Welsh Gardens are some of my favourite gardens in the whole of the globe.
Just as I met you, you asked me if I'd been here, and I spent so much time in childhood coming here, and the Winter Gardens is such an evocative place for me. But we're sitting in a little courtyard here in amongst the Winter Gardens. It's lovely to be back here. I haven't been back here since the pandemic. Just describe this environment and why you think this is a good example of plants, maybe within the urban setting.
Okay, we've got a wide range of plants of all different sorts. We've got a wide range of open space. For example, one of the plants that we'll find in the gardens, and I think it was planted last year, is one of the ginkgo biloba. and it's one of the ginkgo biloas that came from the original tree at Hiroshima. So we have major links with different parts of the world. In fact, when some of my Japanese colleagues were over, I was able to take them to the Japanese garden, which is just across from us, and we were able to look at the likes of some of the poetry, the haiku poetry. I was also able to take them to the winter gardens, where we've got so many different environments, and they're going to be really important for us to start to understand, because we have the hothouses, we have the arid environments, we have the tropical environments, we maybe have some of the wetter environments that our plants are going to have to cope with. By having gardens such as this, we can start to understand what we're going to have to do to adapt our plants for the coming climate changes, whether it's a lack of water or an overabundance of water, which might affect oxygen being taken up by these plants. But not only do we have the winter gardens, I'm in the School of Pharmacy and Life Sciences. I was really fortunate to liaise with colleagues at Duthie Park, particularly Alan Finlay, and we have a physic garden in the community garden at Duthie Park. And I'm interested in bringing together both the science, but the culture and the history. So in 1743, the town council actually wanted a physic garden. So this is an apothecary's garden. So this is a garden that the hospitals could have used for medicines. So they wanted it laid out in what's now Woman Hill. So that was one of the first major gardens in Aberdeen. And then I think it was about 1898, we had the Cruikshank Garden given to the University of Aberdeen. And again, it's a botanical garden. With Duthie Park, we've got children involved in doing some of the planting from the local schools. Whereas at the Cruikshank Garden, at the other part of Aberdeen, we've got the university and that therapeutic benefit. We're all talking about mental health. Well, just coming into a garden can give you that uplifting feeling.
I wondered that as well, what a place like this makes you feel, because I'm just looking around. We've got these beautiful birch. Even just looking at the way that the birch is moving in the wind.
I think the sound. One of the key things about coming to a garden is not just visual.
Yeah.
A garden is totally... it's multi-sensory. You've got the sound of the wind rustling through the trees, through the birch, as you've mentioned. We've got the smell of some of the plants. We've got the smell of some of the herbs. If you're going into some of the different rooms in the botanical garden, you've got the different scents of the different flowers. Some of them are, you just think, are nice smells, but some of these plants are actually medicinal. And what you're smelling is the volatile chemicals that these plants, so the chemicals that are admitted into the air. In fact, some of you might actually use some of the plants in your houses for that nice scent, but some of the plants are really medicinal, and we're beginning to understand the nature of these volatile compounds as we're looking to combat some of the diseases, for example, COVID-19. There are certain plants that are being researched at the moment because they might have chemicals that can interact and stop COVID binding to the cells.
So which plants are they?
They're plants you might not think about, but the evidence, and it's really important as scientists, we always have to look at the evidence. The evidence is maybe early at the moment, but lemon and geranium are two of the plants that can seem to block the entrance of COVID by the manner in which COVID comes into the cells through a particular type of receptor. And that's really interesting for me. I would like to look into that more to see, well, how can we use plants in different ways? We could use plants for their antimicrobial effects against some of the bacteria that we currently have. We can use, for my area, which is cancer research, many of our drugs are plant-based. For example, there's a group of drugs called the taxanes, and they derive from the yew tree, which is really interesting. Many of you might have yew trees in your gardens, and we have particular drugs called paclitaxel and docetaxel, but they come from the European yew tree and the Pacific yew tree. And then again, we maybe have the periwinkle plant. So the periwinkle plant, we have a group of really important cancer drugs called the vinca alkaloids. And these are, again, plant-derived. For heart disease, we might have the likes of foxglove and digitalis. I work with colleagues across the globe, and we know that certain plants grow in different parts of the world, but climate might affect that. So, for example, another group of cancer plants that are beneficial with cancer called the topoisomerase inhibitors. There are particular plants that can give us some of those topoisomerase inhibitors. For example, the Chinese Camptothesa acuminata is a beautiful tree, but from that we can get the camptothecins. And from that, as scientists, we can synthesise the likes of irinotecan and topotecan. Irinotecan would be used perhaps for bowel cancer, might be a useful way of naming it. And for topotecan, well, we can use that for the likes of ovarian cancer, perhaps in different ways. But these are all benefits that the plants can give us.
Fascinating stuff. Morag McFadyen speaking to Helen at the David Walsh Gardens at Duthie Park in Aberdeen ahead of the Fascination of Plants Day on Wednesday.
That must be so exciting, finding a plant that has a major impact on something like cancer. I mean, that would really want you to take up science, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but also, again, thinking in terms of a sort of, you know, broader planetary ecology, we're wiping stuff out at an alarming rate. What are we destroying at the moment, the value of which we don't currently know?
Yeah, same with insects as well. There's, you know, a power of, you know, from food to solutions to many problems, medical problems. You know, just there's so much out there that we don't know about. But we could also benefit from looking to the past, because people actually knew what worked. And yeah, there's a lot of folk working on that. Hey, the bird song's throwing people a bit this morning, because usually Finn or Quentin's absolutely stowed out, but they were challenging people this morning. Helen McDonald says, could it be a bullfinch? She's from Lauder. No, it's not. Chris in Shropshire, is it a turnstone? No. Is it a common sandpiper? That's Andy Ross. We'll have to give
that's a clue. Getting a bit closer, yeah.
Is it a clue here? I don't know. It's got the reputation for being Britain's most stupid bird. That's not going to help.
Got a complaint that's flooded in. Janet from Perth says, morning, lads. Now, please, let's play fair and have no misleading clues for Mr. Bird today. Last week, I heard it and immediately thought, chaffinch. Then I was about to text. I heard one of you say, that would be Ewan, by the way. It was the most colourful bird in Scotland. As there were goldfinches of my bird hanger at that very point, I thought, aha, it must be the goldfinch. So that was my answer, only to learn at the end it was indeed a chaffinch. Shame on you for leading a lady astray. Well, not the first time he's done so, to be honest, John.
The goldfinch has got a wee bit of colour, not much.
Well, what can you do? The Cairngorms National Park is one of two national parks in Scotland, and this weekend they've got all sorts of activities planned to encourage folk to get out and enjoy the huge variety, and it is a massive variety, of what the area actually has to offer. Joining us now to tell us what's happening is Dr. Sarah Henschel, Head of Conservation at the park. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Right, give me an idea behind the whole thing for a start, the Cairngorms Big Nature Weekend.
Well, the Cairngorms Big Nature Weekend gives us an opportunity to open the doors to the national park and celebrate and share everything it has to offer. It's a spectacular place. It's fantastic for families, for visitors, for walkers, for artists, for nature lovers. There's something for everybody in the national park. And we've had 2 years of being stuck inside. Everything's been virtual, but now we're back here in-person events, celebrating all the park has to offer across the weekend.
Now, you kicked off on Thursday, I think, with a discussion about landscapes and livelihoods in Boatley Garden. How did that go?
Yeah, it went absolutely fantastic. It was a great way to kick the weekend off. We had Gordon Buchanan, who chaired a panel for us, and we were able to talk about livelihoods in the national park, the park in the future, the role that communities play, jobs, wildlife, ecosystem restoration, lots of things to talk about. It was a fantastic event, really well attended, lots of great discussion and lots of food for thought. And that led us on to opening the events across the park, 70 different events tailored for lots of different people across the park. So please check our website out. Some of them are bookable. Go to the website, avoid missing out. Some of them you can just turn up, some are self-guided walks. And just to give you a bit of a flavour of what sort of events we've got across the park, we've got a live theatre at Loch Morlick, we've got a nature fair down at Glen Tanner, riverside fun, learning about fly fishing on the River Spey near Granton, tree climbing at Loch Garten, red squirrel hunts at Commentool, and arty adventures over on Deeside. So there's something for everybody all across the park. So please do go and check out our website.
You mentioned COVID earlier there, Sarah. Has how people are using the park changed since COVID?
I think it has, because I think people are feeling more connected to nature because we missed it because it was taken away from us whilst we were in the first lockdown. And I think they're realizing the therapeutic benefits of getting out into nature, whether that's going on a bike ride or a walk in the woods, a bug hunt with the kids, wild swimming, whatever it might be. It's people's therapy, I think, in terms of giving them a boost and making them feel better. And I think, again, because it was taken away from us, I think we now value it an awful lot more than what we did before lockdown.
Are you seeing that effect? Because there was a worry that post-lockdown there would be an immediate rush into the countryside and that that would tail off quite quickly and you get back to where you were before. Do you think that that legacy, that positive legacy of post-COVID is going to last?
I do think it will last. And I mean, naturally, there was a surge because people were absolutely desperate to get out. But people have built these new connections and developed new hobbies and interests out in nature, which I think that they will maintain those. We do see good numbers of visitors across the park. People, whether they're interested in the nature or they're visiting the park for recreation. I think those numbers will remain high because people now realise the benefit of nature.
I'm not asking for an official policy statement here, but, you know, there is a proposal to create a third national park for Scotland. How are, you know, in the two park authorities, how are folk generally feeling about that?
Well, it's very, very, very early days, and it was a very, very recent announcement. The national parks deliver wonderful things for people and for nature and for communities, and that's a really good thing. Anything that is going to deliver more of that could have more positive benefits widely for Scotland. But it's very early days, so we don't know what's going to happen, but great stuff was delivered at Cairngorms National Park Authority and Loch Lomond. And the Trossachs. So,
yeah, some good examples there to build on. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Great, thank you. Check out the website and make the most of what's on your doorstep. Thank you.
I was just about to say that. Honestly. Yes, as Sarah rightly points out, if you fancy heading along to any of those events, there is a link to the Cairngorms Nature Big Weekend website from ours.
It sounds like there's a whole plethora of things to go and see. Oh, yeah. Sounds brilliant. Let's have a quick blast in the mystery bird, because it's really stumping people. Now, it's a lovely sound, and it's a beautiful bird. Well, the female is beautiful. Mm. The male's a bit more drab. And the only place you're probably going to hear it is in the high tops in Scotland. It used to be widespread in Britain, not anymore.
No.
Sorry. John and Lois said, perplexed from Rothie Norman, you'll be glad to know the sheep have been fed already.
Good.
So there's blessed quiet outside. That's all so we can listen to your programme. The downside is we have no excuse for the mystery bird. We haven't a clue. Is it a sedge warbler? No, it's not.
No, it's not. Agnes says, is the mystery bird an oyster catcher from an overcast Errol? No, I think she's contacting us from an overcast Errol, not an oyster catcher from an overcast Errol. There's an anonymous one here saying, a sandpiper, perhaps. You mentioned the Mental Health Awareness Week. I'll be off later to Kemney Village Hall, where Spectrum Singers are holding a workshop on choral singing, 9.30 to 2.30. Sorry, 12.30, all welcome. And Marion in Premney is going to revise her guess to Curlew Sandpiper.
Well, we've got two correct guesses already. There should be a T-shirt for that. There are no prizes before you start phoning. No prizes, just the honour of getting it right, or even getting it wrong.
This came in saying, hello, gents. I actually for once guessed the mystery bird correctly last week. I never ever phone or email with a guess. However, I've finally been compelled to contact you to disagree with your insistence that the chaffinch is the most colourful bird. Surely either the kingfisher or green woodpecker could trump the chaffinch. I would agree with you entirely, but he's absolutely determined. I listen to your show and catch up on a Saturday morning whilst doing the household chores. This means I can pause the programme when I have to do noisy things like hoovering or have to go outside to lay out washing, that kind of thing. Really enjoy the features and stories in the show. Have a good chuckle at the banter between you. And that's Lindy Winton from Peebles.
I still think the pink chaffinch is the winner.
You are off your chump. Honestly, it's ridiculous. Coming up, trust me, friends, we have many, many delights to tempt you with.
We've had dung beetles, carrion beetles, generally decaying poo, and now some pheromones in a bag. What more can you ask for in the morning?
Them's a good question. That is a good question. What more could you ask for when you're trying to sit and have your breakfast in peace?
We've also got the transformative effects of spending time in nature for one young woman suffering from depression. And, of course, and this is scary, people are getting this right, the mystery bird. Now, that's quite a rare sound, but get in touch if you know what makes it. Or even if you don't and just got something you want to share with the group, the email is outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Colin and Mary Abercrombie and Finn, the border collie this Finn, from Dunblane, got in touch. Morning, gents, and thanks for putting on a great show every week. We're still down in Cornwall listening on BBC Sounds and helping our friend Helen, who's walking 630 miles of the South West Coast Path to raise money for the Macular Degeneration Society. Today we pass round Land's End and continue along the south coast. The weather has been fab, with only one morning of rain. Tonight, we're going to a show at the outdoor Manac Theatre, which is perched on the cliffs above Porthcurnow Beach. A magnificent setting. All the best. Well, all the best to you guys as well. 630 miles. Well,
no, I'm actually very envious about that outdoor theatre. I've seen shots of it, and it looks fabulous. You know, if you timed it to get a decent setting sunset, wow, that would be spectacular. Isabel Madden and Gartmore said, good morning. You're so right about the copper beeches. Mine are looking magnificent. And the other trees around my loch are in full leaf. We've got seven goslings and the cygnets are due any day. Ducks nesting, but no ducklings yet. Otter around too. Those two facts may not be unconnected, Isabel. She says, I'm meeting up with friends from Perth and Milngavie today for the Gartmore Horticultural Society plant sale in aid of Strathcarran Hospice at Gartmore Village Hall, which is the kind of thing that, sadly, we can't read out. So, Isabel, thanks very much for that. Earlier we heard from Rachel and Dan Brown of Wild Discovery. They've travelled the world showing people wildlife, but are based in Deeside. You rejoin this as we are wandering through the bracken at the Muir of Dinant Nature Reserve, yet again, in search of adders. The fiddleheads are starting to come up through the old dead stuff. But you could understand why they were warning of high fire risk a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, it's very, very dry at the moment, and particularly in the eastern Cairngorms as well, in a bit of a rain shadow, so it tends to be drier here than over in the west.
See that? Mrs. Lichen.
Oh yeah. This has blown off one of the nearby trees in some of the high winds that we've had. There's actually countless species on these trees because it's such good air quality around here. You get really high diversity of the lichens. And lots of different animals use the lichens as well, either for sheltering in, living in, use it for nesting materials. Of course, there'll be lots of insects in there as well, so other things that eat the insects will be in amongst all of the lichen trying to find their breakfast.
There's just something very fresh about this landscape at the moment because the trees are mostly birch. Downy birch or some rowan and things, but it's all coming into leaf, and it's that sort of super green at this time of year.
We travelled extensively, and with current climate change and the impact of carbon, it doesn't sit easily with us. We could never advocate for other people to not travel because we do so ourselves. However, when we established Wild Discovery, we wanted it to be a company, a wildlife watching company, that basically travelled with purpose. So if you're going to go looking for wildlife, then trying to incorporate conservation bodies and projects that help preserve landscapes or species where they go. So around Scotland, we've got a network of conservation partners that we visit on our tours. So that can be everybody from the Whale and Dolphin Trust out in the Hebrides to Plant Life Scotland. And it means that people who travel with us get to see firsthand what's going on. So they understand in an even more firsthand manner exactly how places are being preserved and species are being conserved. And the same applies abroad as well. So if we are traveling to, say, Cambodia, then you would hope to visit all sorts of different rural initiatives. There are people who are growing rice in a very traditional manner in order to help preserve sarus cranes, for instance, or places where you can see vultures, which nearly went extinct in Cambodia. And it's all about, for us, supporting conservation and really supporting rural and green initiatives. So showing that there are ways of making an income throughout Scotland and the rest of the world that are viable and help conserve nature in the process.
Do you ever get people who sort of come on your trips and argue with any of that, or is it a sort of self-selecting sample? They're all singing from the same hymn sheet before they've arrived.
I think for the most part, people quite often have that kind of thing in the back of their mind. What we do with our guests, we introduce them to the people that are working on the ground, and it just gives them more of an emotional connection to what's going on in the landscape. You know, if you're showing them a rare species, why is it rare? But also, is it there because you've had a whole body of people behind
that species, you know, conserving it and protecting it, it does make for some interesting discussions.
Such as, when was the last one you had? You thought, well, I hadn't thought of it that way before.
Well, conservation is only one aspect of what we talk about on the tours. But, of course, you've got the farming side of things and you've got, you know, things like the grouse moors that feature heavily, particularly in the Cairngorms National Park, and deer stalking and things like this. And, you know, on the face of it, a lot of them are quite contrasting activities, I guess you could say. You know, we talk through what all the different bodies are trying to do, whether it's conserve the landscape or they're trying to reduce the number of deer or they're just trying to make a living out of the land that they've got. And I come from a farming background, so it always makes for interesting conversations when you're talking particularly, you know, about rewilding. A lot of people think, oh, you want to rewild something, which basically means there's not going to be any land for growing any food or for the deer or, you know, our hunting and shooting and fishing, which is, you know, the big traditional activities in the area. So it can be quite an interesting discussion.
And I think it's important, isn't it, to stress that rewilding does not exclude those activities. The purpose of rewilding is, yes, to regenerate some of the landscape, but these activities, such as farming and land management for sports, can coexist with rewilding. And it's really, really important to stress that. We're not talking about excluding people at all when we discuss it, in our opinion anyway.
Mm-hmm. So I've been involved with Wild Scotland and Sail Scotland pulling together the outdoor tourism policy documents for Scottish Government. And there's been some really interesting conversations about outdoor tourism and all the different facets that it involves. But also, you know, one of the biggest issues is land access. And of course, in Scotland, we have the right to roam. But again, that can conflict with people working the land. So in lambing time, for example, you know, you don't want dogs chasing the lambs, but also stalking times, fishing times, disturbance, but then you've also got disturbance from the conservation point of view, so you don't want to be disturbing the breeding birds, the nesting birds, particularly ground nesting birds. And of course we've got now really rare capercaillie that are not doing well at all, and it's trying to balance, you know, people getting out into nature, which following COVID everybody's you know, it's seen a bit of a resurgence and it's great that people are getting outdoors, but we need to do it responsibly. And we need to consider all these different aspects, whether it be the wild plants and animals or more agricultural needs and things like that. Oh, you found a beetle.
A click beetle, yeah.
A what beetle?
A click beetle. I'm not sure if you might even be able to hear this.
You get a special prize if you really actually heard that. It is it's just audible, isn't it? You know, that's it. But, you know, it is a tiny beetle and quite a large microphone. I tried my best. What can I say?
Well, you failed.
Oh, thanks very much. Rachel and Dan Brown there. We'll hear more from them again a bit later when we try and capture some moths. That went well. There was actually quite a lot contained within that. Question came up earlier, where would you like to go in the world? Because there have been lots of places and things. I'd love to go to Antarctica. Would I go to Antarctica now in terms of flying to South America, getting a boat down, just to see it before? I mean, you know, if the ice is disappearing because we're doing things like flying, how do you square that circle?
Yeah, I think we're both selfish enough to jump at the chance if we got offered it, though.
Yeah, I think you might be right, actually.
Yeah, there was a lot in there about...
That's the problem, though, isn't it?
Yeah, the conflict between rewilding and people who live and work on the land. We were actually making a programme, second part of the programme, on the River Tay this week. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that came up there, they're putting a path in from Kenmore, long-distance path from Kenmore to Dundee, mm-hmm. Walking and cycling. And part of the problem is if you get thousands of people coming past an angling beat, mm-hmm. you're going to disturb the anglers who paid mm-hmm. good money to go and do it. Mm-hmm. So you have to put a detour round that piece of fishing on the river. And it's okay if you think about it and you address it rather than just chucking a path in and ruining it for everybody. You've got consideration.
Yeah, but I remember covering a story quite a few years ago where there was a beat on the river. It wasn't on the Tay, it was further up. And, you know, a bunch of, you know, we're not talking about, you know, the aristocracy here. It was just ordinary people who'd managed to club together and buy a wee section of beat. And because of the change of, well, the Land Reform Bill had come, or the Land Reform Act of Scotland had come through, there were whitewater rafters going through it. You know, about every 20 minutes. And they tried talking to each other, you know, they tried speaking to them, saying, look, any chance you could use this, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and we could use it the other days. And they said, no, this is according to the, you know, legislation, we can go through this anytime we like. And, you know, that's a problem.
Yeah, Mystery Bird's getting some people wrong. A couple right, actually. Morning, lovely people. Is it a ring ouzel? That's Alison in Edinburgh. No, it's not. And I think it's a snow bunting. That's Mike Dingwall in Turfins. No, that's not right, but you're in the right part of the world.
Yeah, Ruth Mary Watson in Aberdeenthorpe says snow bunting too, as did Ian in Strathpeffer. Kate in the Air thought it might be a crossbill, as did Richard and Mandy, sadly, back in Exeter. It's a bird which has eluded us despite many attempts to see it at numerous locations in Scotland. We have to beat them off with a stick, Richard and Mandy. And Susie from Spot thought it might be a ring ouzel too. Anyway, it's Mental Health Awareness Week, which is always a timely moment to just think about our own mental well-being and that of others.
And we're all always advocating connecting with nature as a way of improving mental health. And if anything, the COVID pandemic taught us that that's more valuable than ever.
But, and this is a big but, for many folks spending time in the outdoors, it's not so obvious or indeed accessible, especially for young people. New research from the Outward Bound Trust has found that post-pandemic, the mental well-being of youngsters in the UK is actually worryingly low.
Yeah, but remarkable results can be achieved by introducing teenagers to nature, as this young lady will testify.
My name's Ikra, I'm 20 and I'm a second year student in Scots Law and Business in the University of Glasgow. When I was 17, I heard about the Mark Scott Leadership for Life Award, which consists of a 5-day residential where you're outside in Lough Eel doing things like climbing, gorge walking, hiking with a group of people you've never really been with.
Where was the first place that you actually went with them? And can you remember how you felt when you found yourself in that environment?
Oh, it was Lough Eel. And I didn't really have much time to think because as soon as we go, we're told we have to jump into a lake. So I guess fear was the first kind of initial response, because I'm going, I'm afraid of water and you want me to jump into a huge body of water. Scared was the first thing. When I actually did it, I completely surprised myself, because I had always been the kind who sort of sat at the back of the class, studied hard, got my A's, never really did anything outside my comfort zone. So when I got into that freezing cold lake and came out of it, I was like, oh, that's brilliant. I didn't know I could do that. Once I got past the crippling anxiety of jumping into that lake, I just felt really alive, and it felt really good to be using my body actively in a way that I hadn't really for the past 17 or years of my life. I found a sense of calm very quickly once I'd had the chance to sort of settle in and look around, because we had times and placements during the residential where we were by ourselves. So those walks in a very natural environment, at the time I didn't realise it, but it was mindfulness. It was staying in the present and really thinking, gosh, this is absolutely stunning. And it kept a lot of thoughts that we normally have skimming about at bay. So, for example, what am I doing tonight? What's the work we've got to do? What's the schedule for tomorrow? It all sort of came to a standstill when I had a sense of calm just looking at the trees and going, oh, they've been here God knows how many years and still standing. So I can manage a couple of weeks. It was a great, really calming experience.
And what about your relationship with the natural world now? Have you kept that up?
Some would say a bit too much. So some would say I am going out far too much. But yeah, so right now I still keep up with walks, hikes, harass my friends into rock climbing with me. Just last week we did a very calm walk around the park. I think we were walking around 5K, and then we had a nice wee picnic. A few of us are Muslim in that friend group, so we prayed together outdoors, which was lovely. It was very spiritually connecting as well.
It's Mental Health Awareness Week, which is why I'm talking to you now. The theme this year is loneliness. And some of the research that I've done has showed that actually having some kind of connection with a place can help with loneliness. What's your take on that?
My sort of home base, if you will, is just sort of Glasgow Green, those sort of easy walks where I can switch off my brain and just continue walking without thinking too much about equipment and stuff. And I find, for one, you'll meet people on the way, which sounds like every introvert's nightmare. And it was mine for a while. I was going, oh God, there's someone speaking to me. What do I do? But it's brilliant because people are lovely and friendly. You get a few weirdos every so often, but a lot of the people that I've met have just been other walkers who are looking for a conversation. The place is a huge part of that, but ultimately the people who go there, I think, is what alleviates that sense of just feeling alone in the world. Because even if you have people around you, I do think it's sometimes difficult to form the deep connections, especially after COVID and everything, to be able to feel that you're open and honest with others. So something about when you're on a walk together really does that. You're going on the same journeys, and it lends to openness, I think.
How do you think your life would be now if you hadn't had that experience with Outward Bound and been taken off into the Highlands and forced to jump into a freezing cold loch and probably deal with midges and climb hills and just hang around with your peers in nature? How do you think your life would be now? Would it be different?
Hugely so, because I think around the period where I went, I was 17, and around 16 to 18 was where my long-term depression started alleviating. So because of the awards I did, I realized, one, I had a passion for fitness. Although I'm not very good, I can run for about 3 minutes and maybe hold on to a bar for about 10 seconds. That really made me realize it's not about how good you are, but how much enjoyment and fun you have out of things. And a lot of the hobbies I have now, even chess, etc., are things I wouldn't have tried because I had very low self-esteem. And the outdoors and speaking with people helped me feel a sense of achievement and filled my social needs. And it made me realize I want more of this. I would have still been a law student probably, but I don't think I would have had much joy because at the time I was fully just studying. I could remember waking up at 6 a.m., studying till about 10 p.m. and sleeping. I had nothing else heading in my life, and that's where all my self-esteem was really based. So I think I would have been, quite honestly, in a much more depressed state than I am now. Now I'm learning how to live with depression, but at the time I was pretty much just barely managing to be a productive human being.
A big thank you to Ikra there for taking the time out of her studies to speak to Helen earlier this week. The music was Florence and the Machine, and it's a new signal called Free.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in there. I'm drinking it in at the moment. As I say, the gean's out, the beech trees have got that lovely fresh greenness, if that makes sense. You know, it's really vibrant, and there's just so much going on. It's just great to be outside.
There's been a lot of scientific research on how it actually operates. And to be honest, it's kind of irrelevant. If you need it, you should use it. But the trouble is not, you know, the folk that very often most need it can't access it or feel they can't access it. It's getting somebody to actually sort of facilitate it and say, look, it's okay, come along with us. And, you know, loneliness is a really terrible thing. It's a terrible thing.
Yeah, you know? But there is so much out there. I mean, I realise that's a easy thing to say, but we were speaking to people down in Dundee, not what Dundee, it was Perth, sorry, on an allotment. And just getting out in that sense of community as well, talking to people, it's got to be therapeutic.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, loneliness is not being separated from people. You can be seriously lonely in amongst literally millions of people. Having that sense of place, having something that grounds you is really useful. Worth discussing. Anyway, Sunday 1st May was International Dawn Chorus Day. It's become very much an established tradition. Ewan, God bless him, got up in the middle of the night to take part in a broadcast hosted by the Irish broadcaster RTE.
Yeah, the location this week, or this year rather, was Inchgarth Reservoir on the outskirts of Aberdeen. Now, my guest was the very knowledgeable Ian Broadbent, but before we get to that, there was huge excitement when Liam Loftus caught a rather special, but not a very lyrical word, on one of his microphones.
Is that coming through okay for you?
It is coming through loud and clear, Liam. Well done. It's great to have a corncrake.
Yeah, Crex Crex, the Latin name there, that wonderful, wonderful call or song that it has there. A very scarce bird now in Ireland. So just to let our listeners know where the Mullagh Peninsula is, it's a remote peninsula. It's off in County Mayo. So it's in the northwest of Ireland. And these are probably the westernmost corncrakes in all of the world. So that's a real privilege to be hearing that.
What we're listening for you.
So, if you look in the dictionary, the word enigmatic, you'd probably see a grasshopper warbler next to it. This is a little brown bird that migrates to Africa and back, and goes to Africa for the winter. Lives in these sort of wet pastures and makes this tremendous sound. The Latin name for this group of bird is Locustella, so insect-like or locust-like. But some people think it sounds a bit more like a freewheeling bicycle wheel. It's a bit like nature's hearing test. So it's at such a high frequency that as people's hearing deteriorates, sometimes you lose those upper frequencies. And I can be standing here next to my father, for instance, and he'll say, well, there's nothing there. And you'll say, well, can't you hear that? and there it is. He actually went to the hearing aid shop with a recording of Grasshopper Warbler and said, well, I'm not buying your hearing aid until I can you can prove to me that I can hear Grasshopper Warbler through this thing.
Right, well, here's a Celtic Dawn Chorus hearing test. I'll just let this run for a couple of seconds, Derek, and see if you can pick it out.
Sure.
A very rapid ticking. I can hear it there, all right. Yeah. A rhythm machine.
I can't hear
it. Am I hearing aid, Derek?
Am I hearing aid? There is something machine-like about it, and they'll sing for minutes and minutes at a time, just that same note, and it's quite far-carrying.
I'll tell you, Derek, there was a very nervous northeast bird recorder beside me this morning because he was under a lot of pressure to produce the grasshopper warbler. But we've done it. So, no, a box ticked.
It's such a hard bird to say, isn't it? That sound is really the only indication often that you know they're in the area.
I actually can't.
Yeah, no, it's there, I promise you, Derek. Yeah, this ticking sound. And what they do is they sing, they have their mouths wide open and they'll turn their heads from side to side, and it totally changes where the sound is coming from. So even pinpointing where that bird is really difficult. A real ventriloquist. Yeah. So great to have that in the Dawn Chorus.
Another description is fishing reel.
Yes.
That little ratchet click, and it's a tick, tick, tick. We don't have them here on the reserve. We've had them on the island, but only passing through. But you move away to, you know, bogland, you know, moorland areas, not far from here, and you have a good chance of hearing them. They've been heard already in the county.
But I want to go now to County Limerick and say good morning to Hannah Quinn Mulligan.
It's going to sound mad, but we have timed the Dawn Chorus for the same day as is quite traditionally superstitious in farming culture. And we are on my farm here in County Limerick. So usually on May Eve, on the 1st of May, farmers go around with a bottle of holy water to ward off the fairies. So I'm blaming the fairies on what happened earlier.
That's okay.
If they don't make another appearance, I'm hoping to track down the cuckoo for you here in our farm. So we're nestled next to 90 acres of ancient woodland. It's all hazel, it's all ash, it's never been touched. And the corner of our farm that I'm on is home to barn owls, and we've recently had kestrels return as well. And even when I came out at 3:30 this morning, the screech of a barn owl followed me out. So fingers crossed, we get to hear a cuckoo. I have heard him. He's down in the bog. I heard him on Tuesday.
Let's go back to Scotland and say hello again to Ewan McElwain.
Hi, guys. Yeah, it's beginning to get light here. It's quite atmospheric. It's really misty, foggy, har. The herring gulls, thankfully, are leaving the loch, and we'll get that peace and quiet. There's the rookery. They're just starting to get out. We've seen a couple of roe deer just sneaking through the woods, and there's some bats patrolling just above us. What are we hearing now?
We've heard our first chiff-chaff this morning, and chiff-chaff is one of the earlier migrants that show up here, and it seems to be getting earlier as well.
And it's the world's most boring bird, isn't it?
Oh, I wouldn't say that at all, no.
I know a song that will drive you mad. Chiff-chaff, chiff-chaff, chiff-chaff.
Well, it's easy to remember, isn't it? If you're just trying to start out birding and learning your bird song, chiff-chaff is a really nice one to get started with. Normally, we start hearing our chiff-chaffs in mid-March, but we're starting to get more birds that actually spend the winter here. In the UK, we have wintering chiff-chaffs even as far north as Aberdeen here. So it's getting a little bit more and more difficult to tell the wintering birds from the summer migrants.
You always feel a bit sorry for it though, because it thinks it's a warbler, and it's got this horrible song.
well, it is a warbler. The close relative that you'll hear here as well is the willow warbler, and they look virtually identical. But of course, they've got very, very different songs. The chiff-chaff here—it's got that bouncy sort of note. Willow warbler—I always think it sounds a little bit like a drunken guy wobbling down the stairs.
And you thought you heard a black cap as well?
Yeah, there was a black cap here just singing by the outside broadcast truck, actually. And again, black cap's one of these summer migrants that are spending... We're getting more and more records in our gardens in winter.
Could you note, Derek, Ian's been standing here with both ears cupped and listening intently. Are you trying to filter out the wall of noise?
Yeah, absolutely. And things like the grasshopper warbler, if you cup your ears, just put your hands behind your ears, you'll notice the difference, and you'll get the sounds more clearly.
Right, OK, let's have a wee listen, see if we can hear the chiff-chaff. Blackbird kicking in there as well.
So that's your chiff-chaff there.
Chiff-chaff, blackbird and wren going.
And I'm being horrible to the chiff-chaff, did it?
Possibly my favourite thing about the song of the chiff-chaff. Chiff-chaff, chaff, chiff. It gives it the Latin name to the birds. The Latin name is Philoscopus colubita. Philoscopus means inspects the leaves, looks at the leaves. Colubita is from the old Greek for a money lender or a money changer. It's the sound of counting out the coins on a table.
Oh, wow, yeah. Oh, it's not been a wasted morning after all.
A big thanks to Ian Broadbent, who was with Ewan at the Inchgarth Reservoir for RTE's Dawn Chorus broadcast a couple of weeks ago, and to all the other contributors involved. And you can hear more from that in the latest edition of Scotland Outdoors, available now on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, it's such a joy being out with our real experts. It's wonderful. And we love hearing about your bird sightings or any other wildlife. This came from Jan in Orkney, astonished and happy to report that the Scottish nuthatch has reached us here in Orkney and managed to get a photo to prove it. Who'd have thought it? Its colonisation of Scotland continues. And a good job to the Woodland Trust, who've been encouraging Orkney to plant more trees. That's Jan.
But this was followed by another email later in the week saying... Whoops. False alarm, I think. Orkney recorder Russell Neave suggested it might have been a wheat here because I couldn't see the white rump and its beak was black and long and pointed. I mistook it for a nuthatch. Shame, says Jan. P.S. Still love your programme. And we love the honesty contained within that, Jan. Thanks for correcting the record. You're listening to Outdoors live here on Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElwraith. You can catch us on BBC Sounds anytime and pick up all of our programmes from the past month.
And that's also the place to find the internationally celebrated podcast, Scotland Outdoors. We're trying to do two every week, filled with inspiration from the Scottish countryside and beyond. And look out for Wednesday's edition, which features a fascinating walk Helen took with writer Ian Gross up Barra Hill in Aberdeenshire to discuss the hidden histories of our landscape.
If you haven't had a go at guessing the mystery bird, here's our final chance to have a listen.
Now, I thought nobody would get this. How wrong can you be? Finn is worn to a crisp. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Craig Wilson did. Great start to the weekend. Missed the start as I was chasing our new cockapoo puppy. And Peter Dunlop said the clue did help. I've been told not to give any more clues, by the way. Peter in Edinburgh, I should have been yachting in the Outer Clyde where I could still listen to the programme but found some things needing attention. I've seen orca, minke, basking sharks, dolphin, porpoises as well as rafts of seabirds on the west coast. Carol, from the overcast Chapensee in Orkney, said, is it a plover? I'm not sure if it's a golden or ring plover. Well, it's actually neither, but thank you for a brave attempt.
That reference to the cockapoo, somebody said to me last night, what's the fastest land mammal in the world?
I'm guessing it's a cockapoo.
Nope. It's a toddler with something in its mouth. When you've just said, what's that you've got in your mouth? And then somebody came out the back of that and said, swiftly followed me, puppy, with exactly the same thing. Get that out of your mouth! There's a common perception that plant folklore and medicine don't mix, that modern medicine is based upon science and is, you know, it's dismissed as old wives' tales.
Yeah, but as Helen discovered from biochemist Morag McFadgen, there is medical research she's involved with is very much centred on plants and what we can extract and learn from them to improve human health.
We are very much reliant on the plants, and that's one of the key things in ensuring that we have that diversity. When it comes to climate change, you might all think of the Amazon as a key sort of, not only is it the lungs of the world, but it might be the chemist shop of the world. But in Scotland ourselves, we have various plants that have, for example, they have antimicrobial effects. And in the West Coast particularly, but in the whole of Scotland, you're going to find bog myrtle. Well, bog myrtle has been shown to have antimicrobial effects. Again, the scientists need to do a lot more research to see how we can adapt that and utilise that. But if we lose these habitats, for example, one of the plants that you might all be aware of is primrose. And we might lose the primrose because of the change in habitats.
Do you mean the little beautiful yellow one that we get in spring?
I do. I mean the natural species primrose, the Scottish one. It's actually at risk at the moment, and that's really quite scary. I mean, we're just beginning to understand the importance of plants for so many different diseases. So you might come down the motorway and see a field of yellow and automatically assume it's rapeseed. But you might be wrong. It might be a field of daffodils. And that field of daffodils is there because we can actually get a drug called galantamine from it. And galantamine is what's known as an acetyl cholinesterase inhibitor. Basically, what it's doing is helping people with Alzheimer's disease. It's helping that progression of Alzheimer's disease.
Wow, I had no idea that daffodils were involved with that.
Well, not just daffodils, but snowdrops as well. So, and it's a bulb that's important for both of those because that's where the highest amount of this particular compound, this chemical, this galantamine is.
So it's not just for the aesthetic effect that we see these fields?
No, it's really understanding the importance, not just to us as humans, but to the whole of the environment. I have students that are going to be future pharmacists, going to be future scientists. One of the needs for the globe at the moment, in addition to being aware of climate change, is trying to cope with the potential for antibiotic resistance. So
is that because people have used so much? There's so much flying around in the air and the water and so on.
Yes, very much. Not only have we as humans used far too much antibiotics for perhaps a common cold, but our animals, to protect the animals from disease, we've also overused antibiotics. So plants perhaps offer a different way of dealing with antimicrobial organisms, because we're not perhaps looking at one route of killing these organisms, we're perhaps looking at different routes, because plants contain different compounds, different chemicals.
So actually we can learn from the plants?
Very much, yeah, very much. We can learn from how does a plant grow? Where does a plant grow? What does that plant need to grow? Is a plant growing with other plants? Are there connections there? Are we looking at different families of plants growing together? Do they all have the same properties? So, for example, our mints, our lavender, our rosemary, they're all herbs. They all belong to the Lamiaceae family, but they've got different properties that could we perhaps utilise, not only in food, so we can use plants in food and nutrition, but could we use them in a different way, in an antimicrobial way? Could we use them for relaxation? Many of your listeners might be using plants.
Lavender, for sure.
Absolutely. Lavender, very calming. But if you use too much lavender, it can also stimulate you, it can also wake you up. And lavender has been used for centuries for lots of different things. It's been used for helping with relaxation, but it's also been helping with wound healing and burns. And then we've got other plants that people might have in their homes, such as aloe vera. It's one of those plants that might be beneficial not only to the skin. So we're talking about plant-derived skincare, but aloe vera, again, for burns, for that cooling effect with the aloe vera plant. So there's lots of different ways that plants can help. But I think the key thing that's really important as a scientist is really coming down to the nitty-gritty of how that plant can benefit us in the medicinal side of things. And that's one of the reasons for the Physic Garden here, is the opportunity to bring some of my students down, some of the community, to look at some of the plants that they would have used in 1743 that might still be beneficial to us today. For example, they would have had lots of licorice. They would have had rhubarb, a lot of it. So
what would rhubarb be for then?
Very much we're looking towards the digestion, to help with the digestion. But there's lots of other effects of rhubarb, some of which have been researched, some haven't. But if we lose these plants in different parts of the world, then we're losing that resource. For example, golden seal and goldenrod are Cherokee. I believe they're North American plants, which some of us have in our gardens. And there was a hope that with folklore, and we quite often have to look back to folklore to see, well, what did they use these plants for? And was it because they didn't have that scientific information, or was it because actually they worked and there's something we could learn from that? And with golden seal and goldenrod, I think, it was more for respiratory infections. So at the moment, we're all starting to wake up in the science field about the benefits of plants with regards to medicine.
Dr. Maura McFadden there of Robert Gordon University. And Morag is involved, appropriately enough, in organising the Fascination of Plants Day next week. And you can find out all about the events taking place starting from today by following the link on our website. That's for events happening in Aberdeen, but there are others around Scotland too.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. I didn't realise the fields of daffodils and many of them being used for medical reasons. Brilliant. No. Talking about rhubarb, you can't give them. We were recording a programme and there was somebody chasing us. Have some rhubarb, have some rhubarb.
Yes, exactly. We were down at the allotments in Perth, in Moncrief Island, and everybody we passed said, you want some rhubarb? No, fine, thanks. Fine, thanks. We've got rhubarb. I haven't picked any of my own rhubarb yet, you know, which is daft.
We certainly picked some, but it's taken off now. Maven and Drury said, wonder if it's a crested tit. No, it wasn't. Well done on the mental health item, so thank you.
Marian Pitlochry, Gordon Brown and Brownie and Largs all thought the mystery bird must be a ptarmigan. Mary says, I've been listening to your clues and I think they've led me to it. I've seen them in Shehalian but didn't hear them. Fingers crossed. Sadly, no, Mary. And Gordon Brown added, I'm getting married to my mystery bird today in Nethy Bridge. Excellent. Congratulations. I hope you have a lovely day and the weather stays fine for you. John Wheeler in Dunscore thought it might be a greenshank. Hamish Christie from Dalwhinnie thought it might be a twipe. The railway crossing here in Dalwhinnie is still being locked by Network Rail, says, and Janine says, is it a peewit? None of those answers are correct, but we've got hunters are correct answers. I had a splendid time roaming about the Muir Dinnet Nature Reserve with wildlife guides Dan and Rachel Brown the other week, but it was a wee bit like going for a walk with a toddler. You stopped every second step to look at all manner of things. After a fairly unsuccessful search for adders, Dan rummaged around his rucksack and pulled out something rather curious.
We've just hung up a pheromone lure, and there's actually two different lures here, one for a moth called Emperor Moth and another one for Kentish Glory. And these are both species of a day-flying moth, and they are two of the most attractive moths that we've got in the UK. They're big, they're very, very boldly patterned with kind of tans, reds, blacks, greys, whites, really, really beautiful, beautiful moths. And the pheromones that are situated in this little hanging bag replicate the smell that the female produces. So the males basically cruise around the landscape here. They have huge feathery antennae, which are basically their nostrils. So they're picking up, detecting those pheromones, and they're honing in on exactly where that female is. And in this case, the female is actually a little mesh bag with a synthetic pheromone inside it. And it gives us a good opportunity, firstly, to see them, because they're amazing-looking moths, but also to help record new areas where these moths occur. Now, Emperor Moth is quite widely distributed around the whole of the UK, but Kentish Glory is a real Highland special, so it occurs here in Deeside, as well as Strathspey, and up on the Moray coast as well. But it is not common, and it used to be much more widespread. So this helps to give us an indication of where these moths are. And then I'm also just setting up a little net here as well, so that if we have a male come in quickly, then we can hopefully swoosh the net and catch him, and it gives you a chance to see it a bit more closely.
I'm almost frightened to ask, where do you buy pheromone lures?
That's a good question. There's actually an institute in England that is producing synthetic pheromone lures for a load of different moth species. Yeah. And as I said, it helps to be able to record these particularly cryptic species. There's a whole group called the clearwings, which are tiny little fly-like moths, but they've been able to synthesise those pheromones, and you can buy them online. They get shipped up, and then you just pop them in the freezer, along with various other things. Yeah. If you're
in a plain brown wrapper.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, love our goodness. You know, you missed all the fun because Rachel and I were trying to determine what that poo was.
Oh, lovely. Yeah.
A pair of us were down on hands and knees.
We've had dung beetles, carrion beetles, generally decaying poo, and now some pheromones in a bag. What more can you ask for in the morning?
Tell me what you told me earlier about the fact that they're growing dung beetles.
So dung beetles are really, really important in our landscape because they break down dung. And obviously, if you happen to rear livestock, or if you've ever walked through a cow or sheep pasture, you'll know there's a lot of dung there. But the number of dung beetles, particularly in high livestock areas, has declined as a result probably of chemical usage. And so there's now a real drive to actually try and get dung beetles back into pastures. And they're now getting bred and released onto certain farms as trials to see whether you can actually do this. You can bring native species of dung beetle back to help reduce the amount of dung that's actually on the ground.
Absolutely extraordinary. You know, well, we're having to supplement nature.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, because we've gone too far with chemical usage. And although it might help livestock in the short term, it doesn't help the quality of the pasture that they're then grazing on.
Yeah. And I just spotted there's a wood anemone.
Yes.
You know, now there's a lot of them about, but what there's caught my attention, almost a sort of lilac colour with some of them.
Yeah, some of them, they are quite variable, but the lilac is actually the underneath of the petal, what you're seeing there. You see, you've been on the face of it, they're quite white, but underneath, the underside, there's this gorgeous soft lilac colour.
That's beautiful.
Yeah,
really pretty plant.
Lovely mats in the woodland.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of them out at the moment, in amongst the violets and a few other bits and pieces. It's really pretty. And the flowering rushes as well.
So, effectively, having hung our lure, what do we do now?
We wait patiently.
Right, so, okay.
As the pheromones go out in that direction, hopefully you'll see the moths coming in, they'll pick it up and they'll kind of zigzag in and try and pick up the strongest scent and eventually narrow it down to where we are.
Okay.
Oh, it's going to go away again.
Oh, no.
That's it. That might be it.
Came in, had a smile.
Yeah. So that was a male emperor moth. Blink and you miss it, literally.
I did miss it. Yeah. So I didn't even have the recording equipment on it.
Oh, no. So that was your male emperor, and he just literally whizzed in, checked out the lure really quickly, circled it, and has headed off back the way he came. But, I mean, they're flying really fast. How long's that been?
Let's make ourselves feel better about the fact we've been outwitted by a moth. Three grown people outwitted by a moth.
I mean, it's probably doing, 25, 30 miles an hour?
It was clicking on. It was clicking on.
It could well have come from even
2 or 3 kilometres by now.
Seriously.
These pheromones, as soon as they start working, they distribute themselves very rapidly, disperse into the atmosphere, and the emperors pick them up. And in that case, yeah, it wasn't good enough for him. Didn't smell quite right. Not quite the right perfume.
Not quite the right thing. But we've said this, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of times before. You can never guarantee to show people wildlife. But yeah, I bet you everybody who goes out enjoys themselves.
Well, we hope so.
Yeah, that's the aim, yeah, no matter what. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, oh, yeah, wildlife isn't guaranteed. It very rarely turns up on cue. When it does, it's a bonus. There's always something to see. There's always something out there, whether it's insects or plants and flowers and different things. There's always something going on.
Yeah, there's a cuckoo calling now distantly on the other side of the loch. And that's brilliant. It's one of the first of the spring. Yeah. And for us, that gives an immense amount of pleasure just hearing that back. And like Rach says, you never know what you're going to see. And there's this emotional roller coaster attached to wildlife watching. So you have a little bit of disappointment if you miss something. And then all of a sudden, it might appear 10 minutes, 15 minutes, an hour, 2 hours after you were expecting it. And it's such a great feeling to then actually see it.
Or you might find something that you weren't expecting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well.
Yeah.
Even more surprising.
Or you see something hurtle past at 30 miles an hour.
Indeed, it was the best thing ever, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was quite probably.
We'll show you a picture.
On Google. Yeah.
Dan and Rachel Brown of Wild Discovery at Muirdinnet in Aberdeenshire. Now the moment you've all been waiting for, the mystery bird. We've got reams of correct answers for this.
I've been banned from giving clues.
No, exactly.
Sandy Johnson got it right. Peter and Liz Robertson got it right. Bobby and Wormit got it right. Colin and Mary Abercrombie. A lot of people having multiple guests. Mary in St Andrews, Lewis and John, a beautiful, peaceful Rothy. And Andy Ross in Bewley says, is it a dotterel? Loads out. Apologising for not being able to read out any, but we have hundreds.
Quite literally hundreds, and Ian and Tully Nessel added, also known as, I think, the moss fool.
Yep. Many birds have very different reputations. The raven is renowned for intelligence and that all-seeing eye. The dove is a bringer of hope and peace. And the stork is the bringer of new life. Some birds, like the dodo, now extinct, are labelled with a less attractive reputation. They were too trusting of men who simply walked up and hit them with a club for food. Hence, dumb as a dodo. Another, forever linked with being a bit dottery and not aware of its surroundings, is the dotterel. It's a member of the plover family, with a grey-brown body and a bright chestnut belly. Once widespread in Britain, in the summer months, the dotterel is now confined to the high tops of Scotland, building the nests with leaves, lichen and grass stems within a dugout hole in the ground. Although these birds can be seen here from April to October, they're also known for their erratic migration. Not only from nest to nest, but also from country to country during a single breeding season. It's not unknown for a female to mate and lay her eggs in Scotland. And while the male settles on the nest, she hops over to Norway to do the same with another male in the same season. They are gorgeous birds. Unusually, the female has the brighter plumage, which seems to go with her being the dominant partner in the relationship. Once the eggs are laid, the dowdier male incubates and raises the chick while trying, not always successfully, to prevent his partner from mating with anybody else. On the spring migration from North Africa, they're often seen in groups or trips at traditional stopping places. Places where they have been shot with up to 50 pairs per hunter. And, as I've said, as a result, they're in trouble. And 7 years ago, were moved onto the red list of very vulnerable species on the brink of extinction. Climate change, pesticides, all have been listed as possibilities, but much of the decline is historic. Because like the dodo, the dotterel is good to eat and easy to catch. One report details the technique.
In England, the dotterel is considered an article of food, of a great delicacy. It is caught in the night by a lamplight, in accordance with the movements of the fowler. For if he stretches out his arm, the bird extends a wing. If he stretches a leg, the bird does the same. In short, whatever the fowler does, the dotterel will imitate it. And so intent is it on the movements of its pursuer that unawares becomes entangled in the net. The Greek word morinellis, from the Greek foolish, describes the bird because the dotterel has a sweet and trusting nature, which did it no good at all when it was being pursued as game. Anglers too chased the dotterel, the bright breast feathers used in the 19th century ingredients for fish flies. But what really seems to have done for the dotterel as a widely distributed bird is enthusiastic hunting with falcons, nets and guns. They were a delicacy associated with superior dining. And there's a record of Queen Anne Boleyn being presented with a brace of dotterel in 1534. And in another story that she used to keep them in her garden alive until they were ready for the pot. And 70 years later, James VI, when he wasn't hunting witches, was a very, very keen dotterel hunter. As he travelled south to take up his position after the union of the crowns, he visited nobles on the way, distributing knighthoods like confetti, and whenever the chance presented, he was on the hunt for the dotterel. An account of 1628 states the advice that six or seven people should set up nets and then approach the birds from behind and drive them towards the net by the banging of stones. A writer of nature at the time suggests that the foolish bird can be caught at night by candlelight. The sleepy victims will follow the hunter step by step into the waiting nets. They were often imported from France as well, although Lord Lille, the uncle of Henry VIII, and the Lord Deputy of Calais was told to stop sending them over at one point because plenty could be obtained from Lincolnshire. Not anymore. It's estimated that only 400 pairs remain in this country, mainly on Scottish high tops. We lost the dodo forever due to its trusting nature. The dotterel, once widespread, is clinging on, but only just.
The dotterel, or moss fool, according to Ian and Tully Nessel.
Yeah, fascinating stuff, the fact that it imitates people, you know, stretching out an arm and it stretches out a wing, and then you...
And so the hokey-cokey was invented.
Very briefly, Julie, Peter, Alison Inverness, Chris in Shropshire, Peter Cooper and Niall Lewis, he saw one on the Macker one day.
Oh, excellent.
And Jackie Kerr in Corbridge says, thanks for the clue, it's a dotterel.
Wendy and Montrose got it right. David Long from Spottiswood, Ted Pinner, Livingston, Scott Matheson, Stirling, Fred Gordon in Armadale, Rowan Stewart in Aberfoyle, Alistair Coots in Hampshire, Stuart Taylor in Elgin, Sue Ann, Tim Hartman in Kirkwall. I mean, there's lots and lots of people who've got it right.
I would never have got it right. Jeanette Milton in Campsie, Andrew Wilson in Oban, Campbell Gemmell in Darkest Canvas Barren.
Yeah, well, Paddy in Aberdeen, Dunkey in Ullapool, Pam in Lossie, Walter Burns in Kintore. I mean, the list literally goes on. And I have literally... I have to apologise for those of you who got it wrong, because I've discovered a stash of stuff behind the chair that somebody must have put out when I went to the loo at some stage, you know, and it's kind of fallen down the back. So my apologies.
Yeah, Paul and Veronica in Grenoble in southeast France got it right as well.
Excellent. You see, there's no excuse. Geography is no barrier to this. That, sadly, is it for this edition of Out of Doors. This programme will be published as the Scotland Outdoors podcast from noon today. And on Wednesday, our podcast features a walk Helen took with writer Ian Gross up Barrahill in Aberdeenshire, looking at lost and forgotten landscapes. Until then, thanks for listening.